Welcome to the AI Business Podcast, where we feature conversations with interesting guests at the intersection of artificial intelligence and business.
Welcome to the AI Business Podcast. I'm Andrew Brosnan, a principal analyst in Omdia's AI and Applied Intelligence team. I'm very pleased to welcome Petrina Kamya, the head of AI platforms for InSilico Medicine, an AI drug discovery and development company. Welcome and thank you for joining us today, Petrina. Why don't you start with giving us a bit about InSilico Medicine and a bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Andrew. It's an absolute pleasure to speak with you today. So InSilico Medicine is an AI-driven biotechnology company, and our business model is very simple. We develop software and therapeutics, and we license both out. The software side of the business is led by Dr. Alex Zhevoronkov and is built on a strong foundation of machine learning, bioinformatics, cheminformatics, medicinal chemistry, structural biology, computational chemistry. And we use this expertise, this foundation, to build our software platform that is called Pharm.ai. And that's where I sit as head of AI platforms. And then we have our preclinical and clinical team that is led by Dr. Feng Ren. His team uses this software platform to build out our therapeutics pipeline.
So what are some of the problems that you're trying to solve in drug discovery and development with your platform?
Yeah, discovering new therapeutics is an extremely challenging task that is fraught with a number of different challenges on every single stage of the entire process. And our goal is to take AI technologies, adapt them to help alleviate some of the challenges associated with developing therapeutics, such as discovering novel targets, designing small molecule therapeutics, predicting the probability of success of your clinical trials as they transition from one phase to another. All of those are challenges that are associated with making decisions and taking in data and making those decisions. And AI is very well adapted towards doing that. So we're adapting the technology to help people who are in this field make data-driven decisions to decrease the amount of time, to decrease the failure rate, and increase the probability of success of their programs.
Right. And so with this application of AI to the drug discovery and development process, what sort of time savings or cost savings are indicative in leveraging this technology versus more traditional methods?
So AI technology has been shown to outperform humans in many different ways, whether it's in playing a game or in image recognition and analysis. And these are the technologies that we are adapting for use in drug discovery and development. And they are beginning to show promise in terms of the way that they can be leveraged to help address the challenges in drug discovery and development. For example, in the design and discovery of novel therapeutics, that can actually go all the way up to the clinic. The time that it typically takes to discover a novel therapeutic can be anything from 5 to 10 years to get from discovery all the way to phase one clinical trials. What we have shown at InSilico Medicine is that it can take as little as 18 months to do that, from the time you discover your target to the time you nominate your preclinical candidate, and up to 30 months to go all the way up to the clinic. And we're not the only company that has shown that you can do this. Like I said, it typically takes about 5 years, but we're showing that you can do this a lot faster, cheaper, in terms of synthesizing and screening fewer drugs, making them synthetically accessible and optimized for multiple different properties. In terms of the type of impact that this can have on the industry, imagine if this was to be adopted at scale. If more and more companies can produce novel therapeutics and have a robust pipeline in a short period of time using less resources, I think it could have a tremendous impact on the productivity of the industry.
What do you see as some of the challenges or constraints in applying AI to the drug discovery process?
Well, there are many different challenges. The first challenge is, I think, in having realistic expectations of what AI technologies can do. Matching people's expectations to what can actually be done. That's a challenge. Another challenge is in the types of data that are used to build models. We need to have good data, good quality data, not just any old data. A lot of people talk about big data, but if you have big rubbish data, then you're going to build rubbish algorithms or rubbish models. You have to have good, clean data to be able to do that. Another challenge that I see is in the adoption of the technology. A lot of processes are already very well established and ingrained in the pharmaceutical industry, and introducing AI technology into this process is pretty disruptive. And with any change, there comes a barrier to adopting the change. And that's a challenge, right?
Right. And do you see ways of mitigating some of these challenges in terms of, you know, having larger data sets that would help then train better models?
That's one way you could address one of the challenges, and that is in terms of having good enough data to train models, or data that's good enough to build robust and generalizable models. But another way that you could sort of address some of these challenges is in having a culture that is more open to trying out new things and to maybe thinking about addressing problems in a different way, and not expecting one like AI to be the be all and end all, the answer to everything, but just to have understand its strengths and limitations and be open towards testing and adopting these different methods into their existing workflows, maybe replacing some workflows with these technologies, and seeing what sort of impact that they can have. It could be a small incremental change, a small impact, but you know, an impact is an impact as far as I'm concerned. And if there is an impact, be open towards acknowledging that there is an impact there.
Right. And I think, you know, we've already seen, like in Silico Medicine and some other companies out there already have some AI designed or molecules already in the clinic. I think some are in phase one and phase two. I mean, do you think that we're on the cusp of an explosion of AI designed molecules, or do you think that it's more an evolutionary process that needs to happen, and you know we're really it's going to be over a longer period of time where we start to gradually have more and more molecules coming through the pipeline?
Yeah, I would not say that we're on the cusp of an explosion. You know, there are many different stages of drug discovery and development that could benefit from a change in the sort of typical paradigm, the way people work. You know, once a therapeutic is marketed, it has gone through many, many different stages. All of those stages take time. And in terms of AI-designed therapeutics going to the clinic, if you think about it, there's no real difference between an AI-designed therapeutic and a human-designed therapeutic. In the end, they're either a molecule or an antibody. They have to go through the same stages, the same three phases of clinical trials, and the whole process is about 5 to 6 stages, right? And that all takes time.
Right.
And in the end, right, these AI-designed drugs or human-made drugs, they all have to go through what I refer to as phase 4 clinical trials, and that's when they're put out into the general population, which tends to be more heterogeneous than the populations that are the patient populations for phase 1, 2, 3 clinical trials. And only when we have that sort of data will you be able to trust maybe an AI designed molecule. But like I said, there's no real difference in terms of the actual molecules. It could be designed by a human or an AI algorithm. But all of that takes time. So before people can fully trust these AI designed therapeutics, it has to go all the way up to phase 4. And that's not something that is going to be an explosion. It's not something that is going to happen tomorrow. It's going to take years to get there. But yeah, that's what I think. So I think we're going to see more and more AI designed drugs getting there. But you know, it's not an explosion. This is going to take time.
And so we've seen some other industry stakeholders talk about, like Frank Nestle, for example, from Sanofi, and some other key stakeholders talk about leveraging AI to actually reduce the number of molecules that you synthesize in the early stages from the likes of around five traditional drug discovery processes taking 5,000 molecules before they have a molecule that they that goes through to stage phase three and out to the market. And you know, how does AI, the application of AI, help in narrowing down the actual number of molecules that, that you then synthesize in wet labs, for example?
Yeah, this is a good question. So by decreasing the number of compounds tested, screened, synthesized, you are saving millions of dollars because synthesis is very expensive and time consuming and challenging. And the way AI helps in terms of reducing the number of compounds that are synthesized is by having intelligent algorithms that can design molecules that are easier to make, simpler to make, use known reactions, and molecules that are optimized for multiple different properties. So oftentimes you'll synthesize one round of molecules where you're screening them for potency. And then once you have, okay, you've selected a certain number of molecules that are potent, you then try to optimize them for another property. And then you synthesize those and then you test them and you build libraries and libraries of compounds so you can understand the structure activity relationships around a chemotype. That just keeps being, you know, adding with each step of optimization. With AI-driven platforms like our platform, Chemistry 42, those molecules are optimized at the design stage for all of these different properties. So you don't have to keep synthesizing big libraries of compounds to optimize for one property. These properties are designed into the molecules, and the molecules, one of those properties is synthesizability. So by having those molecules optimized during the first cycle, so we typically synthesize only about 50 to 150 compounds before we nominate a preclinical candidate. The only way we're able to do this is by, at the design stage, designing molecules that are optimized for multiple different properties so that when you're actually making them, you're making fewer molecules.
So it's a multi-parameter optimization process.
That is correct.
Right. Yeah. And you're coming up with a scoring system?
Yes. That's right. So for the chemistry platform, we basically have an AI engine, and then we have a reward engine, a reward function. The AI engine consists of the generative models that have been pre-trained to go out into chemical space and design drug-like molecular structures. These structures are then passed on to the reward function that then screens these molecules and awards them scores based on how well they satisfy certain criteria. If any criteria is lacking in the molecules that are designed, the molecule will be penalized. We'll be given a low score for that functionality or that property. And if the molecule has or satisfies a lot of the criteria, it will be given a higher score. And that information is fed back to the generative algorithm. So as you're running the platform, those algorithms are learning what types of molecules are high scoring, are optimized for different properties, and those molecules that are not optimized. And it keeps wanting to, it's been tasked to generate high-scoring molecules, so molecules that are optimized across the different properties that you're looking to optimize them for.
Right, and it can also be a bit of a trade-off process, right, where you may have insolubility or absorption, those kinds of different parameters. You could have ones that score highly in one of those but low in others, right?
That is correct. Absolutely, yeah.
Right, and then you come up with an average score based on all of those different parameters, right?
Yes. This is sort of what we call data-driven decision-making. So you're going to have scores for these different molecules that will tell you, okay, this molecule maybe is better in terms of its predicted potency, metabolic stability, CYP inhibition, but maybe it's lacking in one property. You can then take that molecule or that family of molecules and make a small change to the structure and rescore it. And see how it scores. Maybe it'll improve in terms of its CYP inhibition or whatever property that was predicted not to be optimal. But you're doing this in silico, right? This is all virtual optimization before you go out and test them. So when you're going to test or synthesize those molecules, you know, okay, I'm going to select the top five that have been predicted to have the best profile. You synthesize those five, maybe four out of those five will have the right sort of profile you're looking for. And this is opposed to synthesizing and testing or screening libraries of thousands of molecules.
Right. And then we move on from that synthesis into testing, right? And then we move into phase one, potentially, right? And I believe that, you know, your platform also helps with some of the selection in terms of clinical trials. Is that right?
Yeah. So we have a platform that we're launching next week that will help you make decisions regarding which targets, which disease target partners, indication partners, which molecules have a higher probability of success of phase transitions in your clinical trials when you're designing your clinical trials. So just by inputting the target choice and your disease into this platform, you can get a probability of success of transition from phase two to phase three. So what I have done, and just for fun, is taken a bunch of targets that were identified using one of our platforms and putting them into our clinical trial outcomes prediction platform in Clinico and asking the platform of these five targets, which ones would have a higher probability of success if we were to take them to clinical trials for a particular disease. So this was ALS and we had nine targets, and it very nicely ranked them. So of the eight, there were four that had a higher probability of, had a higher chance of having a successful phase two to phase three clinical trial compared to the other three. Now, that's not to say that you're going to discard the other three. I'm doing bad math here. I said there were eight targets. So four were predicted to be good and four were predicted to have a lower probability of success if you were to take them into clinical trials. So that just helps you prioritize the targets, right? So let's start off with these four that had a higher chance of being successful in clinical trials. We'll keep the other four, but we're going to go ahead with these four initially, validate them, you know, make sure that they are implicated in the disease experimentally, and then move on and design molecules for them that would inhibit their function. But yeah, basically it can help you rank and prioritize all the way from the early stages, from where you're deciding which targets to go after for a particular disease. But it takes all sorts of other information into account as you're moving your programs forward in terms of patient population choice, the whole clinical trial design. All of these different aspects, these different features can help have an impact on the probability of success as you transition from one phase to another in your clinical trials.
I mean, does it also have the potential then to identify more precise patient populations when you take the molecules through trials and potentially shorten the time that the molecule is actually going through these different phases of clinical trials?
No, you can't shorten the phases of the clinical trials, but you can. It can help you select a patient population that would have a higher probability of success of that particular phase of your clinical trial. Yeah, absolutely. Even the geography. So where you have your clinical trial, all that data can be taken into consideration to help you optimize your clinical trial design to increase its probability of success.
So tell us a little bit about sort of the future in terms of where we go from here in terms of AI and sort of addressing some of these challenges and what's next for the company going forward.
I think that AI has the potential to have incremental impacts on all of the different stages of drug discovery and development. I mean, so far what we have shown is the impact on the very early stages of drug discovery and development. So target identification, small molecule design, and then looking to optimize the probability of success of your clinical trials. But at every single stage of drug discovery and development, I do believe that AI has the potential to have an impact. And not only in terms of the technology or you know, I think it could have an impact on the later stages. So in clinical trials, maybe in terms of making sure that there's better adherence to the clinical trials, you know, with your patients so that you have less patients dropping out. So building that kind of technology and that sort of infrastructure that will increase the impact and the success of your clinical trials. In terms of in silico medicine, we are going to continue to innovate in this space. I don't think we're a very small and agile company at the moment, but I do think that there is no shortage of ideas and willingness to put these ideas to the test. So we're going to continue to innovate in the AI space, in the technology space, and we're definitely going to continue to basically put our money where our mouth is and build out robust pipelines of therapeutics that mitigate the risk of having one or two programs and increase that productivity, show that it's possible, demonstrate that it works. We're also looking to adopt new technology and build out new technology. So we're building a robotics lab to that end in China, in Suzhou. We're just going to continue to innovate and continue to demonstrate the potential that AI technology has on all of the different stages of drug discovery and development.
Yes, I mean, that's very interesting. And talking about robotics, I mean, is this moving towards robotic synthesis? Right, and so you're sort of automating more steps of the chain, if you will, of the value chain. Do you foresee it becoming a completely automated process in the future, or will we always have a chemist or humans in the loop, so to speak?
Yeah. So the robotic capabilities that we're building out is not in synthesis. I think that's got a ways to go. Synthesis is very tricky. Unless you stick to a very few number of reaction types, it's very hard to automate that, in my opinion. We're looking more towards automating target validation. So all the little screens that you have to do to validate a target, that could be automated because those are sort of standard for different disease areas. In terms of having drug discovery fully automated, I don't think that's something that is likely to happen, because drug discovery involves human health. It involves lives. And wherever you have lives involved, patients involved, sickness, you have to have a human element in there, in the process, helping make decisions that a computer cannot make. And bringing in a human touch, I think I don't think that it will be fully automated or like a roboticized process. You punch in an idea and out comes a drug that will go through all the phases of clinical trials. There has to be a human in the loop.
So how do you see the changes in terms of with the introduction of AI into the drug discovery process? Do you foresee this having a change in the skill sets that scientists have? Will they need to expand their knowledge beyond traditional chemistry and biology into more computational disciplines?
I think that as a scientist, a life scientist, you do have to take mathematics and physics and those sort of disciplines as part of your training. But I do believe that if students were taught mathematics in the context of real world applications, not just here's an equation, here's a formula, but actually what these equations and formulas can have, the impact they can have on real world situations, then I think more life scientists would have a better grasp of mathematics. But that being said, I think it's very difficult to be masters of all. So interdisciplinary collaboration, in my opinion, is key to the success of the adoption of these technologies. And just having people from all sides from all different skill sets, understanding that they're working towards a common goal is what is, I think, going to drive innovation in this space.
So going forward, sort of more multidisciplinary teams working together?
Yeah, absolutely. And for that education to start at school, so that students understand that in order for you to be able to innovate and if you're interested in healthcare or in drugs, that there is a mathematics component, that there is chemistry, there's biology, there's physics, and together having a basic understanding of that will just boost the potential of all these disciplines in the real world.
Where do you see most of the innovation coming from going forward in terms of AI in the life sciences? Do you see it coming out of academia or biotechs or big pharma, or do you think it's more of a collaborative collaboration amongst the different stakeholders?
That's a good question. I don't think that innovation is going to come from one place. I think innovation comes from many different places, but collaboration, again, is key. So pharma has information that academia doesn't have, and small techs have the they're nimble and they're agile. And you know, when one of the reasons I really love working at In Silico Medicine is your ideas are listened to. That doesn't happen in a big company. Well, in my experience anyway. So learning from each other and using each other's strengths to collaborate, that's where innovation is going to come from. It's not going to come from one place or another because we don't all have the same strengths.
Well, I think, you know, when we look about, you know, not just In Silico Medicine, but some of the other companies that are leveraging AI in the drug discovery process, right? In the early stages, as I think with your omics platform, the process is to ingest a lot of information from the scientific literature, right? And from other sources as well. And other people have spoken about how, you know, there's signs within the literature in terms of potential targets, for example. And my question is around, you know, there's also been concerns around reproducibility of experiments conducted in scientific papers, right? And I was curious as to how this might have an impact upon these novel discovery engines. In terms of how is there some sort of validation involved, or because we're using what is known out there to then draw correlations or in hypothesis, right? And so I was just wondering if you had a view on this reproducibility concern within some of the literature having impact upon the novel discovery process.
Yeah, this is a very good question. So if I've understood you correctly, there could be a bunch of experimental data out there that is maybe not validated, that could influence an outcome that we're predicting, say, with a target. So a relationship between a target and a disease. It's based on something that may not be validated. Yeah, there's several different ways that we address this type of concern. One is the ability to upload your own data sets. Okay, so you can have your own data and you can mix and match data as well to mitigate or to, how do I say this, to reduce the impact of erroneous data. So if you have multiple different data sources for a particular disease, you're looking at the differential gene expression, right, between your controls and your disease samples. If you only have one data set, maybe from a paper, then you're hugely reliant on that scientific team's, you know, experiments and their validation and their outcome. But what the platform does is it uses multiple different data inputs to come up with a conclusion. That's one. And a myriad of different scoring algorithms, so that if there is one that just stands out, that seems to be an outlier in terms of the outcome that you're looking for, that will become immediately obvious. You're not just relying on data from one experiment, you're relying on multiple different scoring algorithms, multiple different data sets, and you can mix and match. So you can try and trip it up. If you see something that looks a bit odd, take another data set and see what that does to the data. Do you still see the same output? So by having different data types, different sources of data, by looking at different attributes, you're reducing the chances of you picking up on something that is due to a mistake.
Yeah, so you're bringing in multiple sources, and so your risk of having something erroneous is reduced through multiple data sources.
That is correct. And all the data that we upload onto the platform itself, we have carefully curated. Like, we have a dedicated data curation team that combs through the literature, cleans up the data, and only those data sets that are clean, that are usable, that are validated are what we upload onto the platform itself.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Petrina. It was a very interesting conversation. You're welcome. All the best with you and In Silico Medicine. Thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you, Andrew.
To get more AI news and insights, visit our website at aibusiness.com. Until next time, thank you for listening.